Thursday mornings at 9, right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101 FM.
Hey, this is Dr. Loco, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org, an unlicensed, commercial-free community radio just for you, so you should support it too. Bueno, bye.
Oh, man, gracias.
And stay tuned for more Riff and Raff with Bathrob Spears Broadsides coming right up.
And the business ain't dead, it's only a sleeping. Dreaming someday that a customer will come. The customer ain't dead.
The customer ain't dead.
He's only a-sleeping.
Only a-sleeping.
Dreaming someday.
And a-dreaming someday.
That a good job will come.
A good job will come.
That good job ain't dead.
That good job ain't dead.
It's only a-sleeping.
Only a-sleeping.
Dreaming someday.
And a-dreaming someday.
That a paycheck will come.
A paycheck will come.
That paycheck's not dead.
That paycheck's not dead.
It's only a sleeping.
It's only a sleeping.
Dreaming and a dreaming.
Dreaming and dreaming.
That the president's gonna come.
The president's gonna come.
Well, the president's not dead.
Only half dead.
And only a sleeping.
Sleepy sleep.
Sleeping and dreaming.
And a hoping and a praying.
That old atom bomb won't come.
Old atom bomb won't come.
That atom bomb ain't dead.
Atom bomb ain't dead.
It's just about half sleeping.
Just about half sleeping.
Sleeping and a dreaming.
Sleeping and a dreaming.
That a new world's gonna come.
A new world's gonna come.
That new world ain't dead.
That new world ain't dead.
It's not even sleeping.
Not even sleeping.
It's a waiting and a wiggling.
And a wiggling and a waiting.
For you and me to come.
For you and me to come.
Now you and me ain't dead.
You and me ain't dead.
We're both just pretending.
Both just pretending.
We're waiting and waiting.
And a looking and a watching.
For a big job to come.
For a big job to come.
Well, the business ain't dead.
No business ain't dead.
It's only a sleeping.
Only a sleeping.
Dreaming someday.
Dreaming someday.
That a customer will come.
And welcome to Bathrob Spears Broadsides. That was Business Ain't Dead by the New World Singers. Words by Woody Guthrie and melody and adaptation of Mother Ain't Dead. Apparently this was a song that was found after Woody Guthrie's death from Huntington's chorea. He apparently wrote, according to these linear notes I'm reading from this Broadsides collection, from 1940 to 1949. Gil Turner found this song, Business Ain't Dead, among a set of tapes in Guthrie's publisher's office. The publisher, Richmond Organization, had given Woody a tape recorder to take home to document many songs that he had not recorded otherwise. Guthrie recorded the song in 1951 but never released it commercially, and the New World Singers sang it as part of the session for the first Broadside record in 1962. It's transcribed onto lyric sheets, now held by the Woody Guthrie Archives, 1955, and you just heard it. Business Ain't Dead. So, welcome to Bathrob Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norse. The call-in number here, in case you want to jump on the air and say something that I've forgotten or am not mentioning, is 427-3772, 427-3772. It looks like, looks like the mic is kind of down. That's a little better, I guess. How are we doing there? Yeah. No. I think we have a better mic here, perhaps. Yeah, maybe. I'll work on both these mics. Could be doing some kind of article reading, playing some tapes from the street today. The name of the show is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm Bathrop Spear Robert Norse, as I call myself. Actually, I was called that a couple decades ago, and we were actually doing more active protesting to help end laws against the criminalization, well, against the homeless that criminalized them. Laws have gotten worse. Homelessness hasn't gotten any better. The economy has gotten worse, and we're still fighting, or struggling, if you will. I've been listening to a lot of stuff on the history of nonviolence, and while I kind of try to look at a variety of perspectives on how to make real change, it's quite moving to hear about the history of nonviolence, particularly by its advocates. And I'm going to play a little bit more of the audio tape of Mark Kurlansky's book. I think it's 25 Lessons in Nonviolence. Do I have the name right? I only have one of the tapes with me. I've actually sent away for the book, but it's available on audio tape at the main central branch of the library once I return it to the library. And I played a bit of the history of nonviolence in terms of Christian nonviolence in the first few hundred years of Christianity and the history of violence at the hands of the Catholic Church in the next few hundred years and the Roman Empire. I'm going to kind of skip ahead and play a bit of the more recent use of nonviolence as a tactic for political struggle and change by activists like Mohandas Gandhi, Bayard Rustin, and A.J. Mustey, others in this country in the 20th century, the century that's just gone by. Some of you old-timers, some of you real old-timers probably remember it, older than I. Some of you somewhat old-timers probably heard about it, as I did, and read about it. And who knows, maybe some of you younger folks, younger than me, I'm in my 60s, are interested in the subject nonetheless. So I'm going to play a bit of this, and do let me know if you're falling asleep. Give me a call, and maybe you'll do a few wake-up interruptions. And I'm also going to be covering some news stories, running some audio from the street, and I want to announce that Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs co-founder, will be on the air next Sunday, coming up 3 days down the road. He's not sure exactly when he's calling in, so you have to kind of keep checking it out between 9:30 and 1, which is the morning show that I do on Sunday mornings. Keith McHenry, or Katzenjammer Keith, as I call him, is hoping to come to Santa Cruz to do a benefit. He's considering doing a benefit for Free Radio Santa Cruz. And he's also hoping to do some speeches up at the University of California. He has been he was involved in writing the original Food Not Bombs book and engaging in the original Food Not Bombs activism under that name back in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the late 70s, early 80s, and was arrested literally hundreds of times in San Francisco, struggling to give out food to hungry people and to do so in a way that showed the absurd priorities, hence the name of the organization, Food Not Bombs. So he'll be coming in by phone, assuming I remind him, which I hope I do, on Sunday morning, so you can listen to him then. If you want to hear some of his old interviews, you can go online and check out some of the back archives of this show, which can be found at www.huffsantacruz.org, HUFFSantaCruz.org. Huff is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group that meets every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 10:30. We met yesterday. And we plot and plan and sometimes just chatter and babble. One of our most recent activities was to kind of keep an eye on harassment of folks on the benches. Benches are disappearing downtown. There's now a one-hour limit on sitting on the benches. And we received complaints from Brian Parquette, a local guy, who talked about getting particular harassment from the CEO slash office manager of Nextspace, Jeremy. And Jeremy is doesn't deny that he's had harsh words with Brian and abused him even, calling someone a faggot drug dealer is sort of a, loudly, is sort of both sort of a, it may rise to hate speech, and it certainly is abusive, and I've been trying to kind of, well, maybe inappropriately do a little mediation, offer to mediate, but there is a tendency on the part of people in businesses to think they own the benches, or to think they, you know, that their spaces extend out into the public space. I don't know if this necessarily applies to what Jeremy has done, but we certainly see it up and down the avenue with the downtown ordinances that make most of the Pacific Avenue sidewalk, and in fact all business sidewalks in all other parts of the city, forbidden zones. It's illegal as a fine if you sit down anywhere on the sidewalk, even if you're not obstructing anything, or if you are setting up a political table, or if you're trying to street perform with an open guitar case. That's only allowed in very limited areas on Pacific Avenue and not at all on other streets and other business districts due to merchant-backed anti-homeless laws, as I call them, laws that attempt to essentially give the merchants more power than they need, deserve, or is advisable to pass on to them. Anyway, I'm going to begin now with a bit of this historical Mark Kurlansky analysis, sort of his. It's an interesting history of nonviolence, and it's narrated by Richard Dreyfuss, I think, who does a good job. I like him as an actor. I think he's quite intelligible and articulate as a book reader. So you be the judge, and here we go.
Chapter 10, The Rule of Thugs and the Law of Gravity. From Mohandas Gandhi, published in Young India, October 1st, 1931. Whether mankind will consciously follow the law of love, I do not know. But that need not perturb us. The law will work, just as the law of gravitation will work, whether we accept it or no. And just as a scientist will work wonders out of various applications of the laws of nature, even so a man who applies the law of love with scientific precision can work greater wonders. Since the close of the 20th century, it has become commonplace to refer to it as the most catastrophically bloody century in history. Lenin, who saw war as an inevitable stage of capitalism, had predicted this at the century's beginning. By the end of the century, an estimated 187 million people had died in war, the equivalent of 10% of the planet's population at the outbreak of World War I. That made it a record century, but also a far higher percentage of war fatalities were civilian than in any previous century. In World War I, one-fifth of casualties were civilian. But in World War II, it went up to two-thirds. In 21st century warfare, such as in Iraq, the casualties may be as high as 90% civilian. But it is seldom mentioned that the 20th century was also the greatest century for nonviolent activism. From 1945 until the close of the century, the world saw more victories for nonviolence than ever before in history. It started with a peculiar man in India, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, called Mahatma, the Great Soul, was an example of how a rebel genius was killed and then turned into a saint, the easier to ignore his legacy. for Gandhi did not want a militarized India with a nuclear weapons program. Gandhi was a quirky man with a mischievous sense of humor. Asked what he thought of Western civilization, he replied, "I think it would be a great idea." But he was not a narrow nationalist. He was a British-educated lawyer, influenced not only by his own Hinduism, but also by Jainism, Buddhism, and the teachings of Jesus. He was a great admirer of Leo Tolstoy, who had withdrawn to his country estate to rail against Christian clergy for denying the true teachings of Jesus. "Thus it is that these nations have become attached to a false Christianity," Tolstoy wrote, "represented by the Church, whose principles differ from those of paganism only by a lack of sincerity." Gandhi and Tolstoy corresponded with each other. Gandhi was also an admirer of Henry David Thoreau, whose small book, Civil Disobedience, written while the author was in prison, Gandhi had read while himself in prison. Gandhi was attracted to eccentric theories of sex, diet, and bodily functions. He had lusts and passions that infuriated him. A tiny man, as a youth, he defied his parents' interdiction against the eating of meat, hoping that a meat diet would make him large and strong, like the carnivorous British. His marriage had been arranged when he was 13, and lasted until his death 62 years later. No doubt a good Freudian would have liked to have had him on the couch. At 16, his father died while Gandhi was having sex with his young wife. He later said, "This shame of carnal desire is a blot I have never been able to efface or forgive." This seems to be at the root of an impulse to deny physical pleasure. Into old age, he convinced attractive young women to lie naked through the night with him in order to test his resolve to remain chaste. He also lived much of his life without money or possessions. Despite frequent expressions of inward doubt, he always displayed a confidence that allowed him to take unpredictable and unfashionable positions. He was fond of a quote from Thoreau, "The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do any time what I think right." He supported the British in World War I, despite his absolute rejection of warfare, a position that left his followers confused. Gandhi believed that to defeat an enemy, the enemy must not feel defeated or humiliated. He did not want the British to be bitter, as they would have been if India turned against them in the World War. He had no doubts, however, about the power of nonviolence. In 1921, he wrote, "Given a just cause, capacity for endless suffering, and avoidance of violence, victory is certain." This confidence reassured his followers and unsettled his adversaries, though neither completely understood him. The British tended not to take him seriously. Like the American revolutionaries, he advocated the making of homespun and rejected use of cloth from British mills. To the British, this made for a comic figure, the spindly little man dressed in beggar's rags. Many British leaders, including Winston Churchill, spoke scornfully of him. When the British colonial government finally and reluctantly recognized that he was a man to be reckoned with and agreed to meet with him in 1931, Churchill angrily snorted about the nauseating and humiliating spectacle of this one-time inner temple lawyer, now seditious faker, striding half-naked up the steps of the viceroy's palace, there to negotiate and to parley on equal terms with the representative of the King Emperor. Gandhi wrote to Churchill, "I would love to be a naked faker, but but I am not one yet. A faker is an Indian monk who wanders begging for sustenance. But the real Gandhi, unlike the saint, was not a dreamer. He was a tough pragmatist who focused on winning. As he pointed out, strength does not come from physical capacity. It comes from an indomitable will. Churchill soon understood that this combination of nonviolence and pragmatism made Gandhi a dangerous opponent. In 1935, he said, "Gandhiism and all that it stands for must finally be grappled with and crushed." Gandhi was first and foremost a political activist, and he had utter contempt for non-active pacifism. Like William Lloyd Garrison, he regarded such a passive stance as cowardly, calling inaction rank cowardice and unmanly, and said that he would rather see someone incapable of nonviolence resist violently than not resist at all. "Violence is any day preferable to impotence," he wrote. "There is hope for a violent man to become nonviolent. There is no such hope for the impotent." Feeling so strongly about the distinction between nonviolent resistance and pacifism, he was dissatisfied with the absence of a proactive word for his beliefs. Ahimsa, nonviolence, the absence of violence, did not begin to express the active nature and the strength of a program of political action, and so he created the word satyagraha, literally, truth force. He began his first satyagraha campaign as a 35-year-old lawyer in South Africa, and after 7 years got the South African Indian government to agree to end discrimination against Indians. Black Africans have frequently criticized him for having failed to show any interest in the plight of the black South African majority, but Gandhi was unpredictable. He expected his loyalty to Britain during the war, a gesture few understood, to be repaid with moves toward independence after the war. But the British appeared unmoved. In the 1920s, he began campaigning for Indian independence with strikes, boycotts, and protests. It is notable how much his program to expel the British resembled the American program before it turned violent in 1775. Like a 20th century John Adams, Gandhi wrote in 1930, "Much can be done. Liquor and foreign cloth shops can be picketed. We can refuse to pay taxes if we have the requisite strength. The lawyers can give up practice. The public can boycott the courts by refraining from litigation. Government servants can all resign their posts." The argument is frequently made that Gandhi was able to succeed only because of the gentle nature of his opponents. Religious philosopher Reinhold Niebuhr, for one, in his long-standing disagreements with Abraham Johannes Musty, a Calvinist minister turned labor organizer turned peace activist, argued, "Pacifism was irrelevant in dealing with Hitler." There are several problems with this argument, the first being that the Danes and isolated groups of religious pacifists in other countries had demonstrated that even against Nazis, nonviolence could achieve some goals. But those who dismiss Gandhi's accomplishments because they were only against the British are also overlooking how ruthless and brutal British colonial rule could be. The history of British rule on the subcontinent belies this myth, especially their treatment of the Pathans along the Hindu Kush with its strategic Khyber Pass, where the British tried to control by fear the gateway from Afghanistan to India for a century. In 1842, the British attempted to secure the area by sending their 4,500-man Army of the Indus through the Khyber Pass. One survivor made it to Fort Jalalabad. But the British were determined to subdue the Muslim tribesmen, the Pathans, who were said to be one of the most warlike people in the world. So were, it is so easily forgotten, the British.
This ends side one of cassette.
The British sent expedition after expedition into the Pathan Hills, an area known to the British colonial army around the world as the Grim. In the 19th century, they shelled the Pathan villages. In the 20th century, they bombed them from the air. Thousands of Pathans were flogged or otherwise beaten, but Pathan snipers fired ancient handmade rifles from somewhere in the rocky crests. Then in the 1930s, something happened that made them more dangerous, more threatening than the British Army had ever imagined. The Pathans joined up with Gandhi's nonviolence movement. The British knowingly asserted this was a trick, that Pathans were not capable of nonviolence. They sealed off the area and for two decades brutalized the nonviolent resistors. Pathans were shot down in large groups, tortured, jailed, flogged, imprisoned for life in distant Indian Ocean penal colonies, or hanged. The British Army burned their fields and their houses. There was no due process of law in the Pathan zone. Their leader, Abdul Ghaffar Khan, called Badshah Khan, the Khan of Khans, was almost the complete opposite of Gandhi, the gentle Hindu. A photograph of the two of them appeared to be manipulated, for Badshah Khan, the Pathan aristocrat, was a mountainous man, with broad shoulders and a square, strong-featured face, surrounded by the thick hair of his head and beard. Gandhi, from the humble side of a middle-class caste, barely came up to his shoulders and was frail, and his baldness gave roundness to his small head. But they were firm allies, determined to build through nonviolence an independent India for Muslims and Hindus together. In 1929, a young man who had heard Khan speak gave him the idea of organizing in a way that was consistent with Pathan tradition. And so he recruited the world's first nonviolent army, the Khudai Khidmatgars, the Servants of God. Any Pathan could join Khan's army by swearing an oath to renounce violence and vengeance, to forgive oppressors, and to embrace a simple life. Khan quickly recruited 500 soldiers, who opened schools and maintained order at gatherings and demonstrations. Khan went from town to town, urging Pathans to rise up in civil disobedience. In Peshawar, when Khan was arrested by the British, the entire town's population took the oath and joined his army. The region was stopped by a general strike, and the British sent in the army with armored vehicles. When they began firing into the crowd, the demonstrators stood stoically. Some were shot many times. One boy walked up to a soldier and asked him to shoot him, and the soldier shot the boy dead. As people fell, others moved forward to be shot. The British continued shooting for 6 hours, and then began the work of hauling away the bodies and burning them. The result was that 80,000 new volunteers took the oath and joined Khan's army. One platoon of an elite Indian regiment, the Garhwal Rifles, refused to fire, and every man in the outfit was sentenced to stiff prison terms, one for life. And even when negotiations forced the British to release political prisoners, all of the Gervalis were made to serve their full terms. The British tried to provoke the proud Pathan soldiers into breaking their vows of nonviolence. Huge, powerfully built men were publicly stripped, humiliated, beaten with rifle butts, poked with bayonets, thrown in cesspools. Some killed themselves to avoid breaking their vow. In prison, Badshah Khan explained to his jailer that he was a nonviolent follower of Gandhi. The British deputy commissioner asked him what he would be doing if he hadn't met Gandhi, and Khan put his large hands on the two bars in front of him and easily bent them apart. Khan's stated concept of Islam was this. The Holy Prophet Muhammad came into this world and taught us that man is a Muslim who never hurts anyone by word or deed, but who works for the benefit and happiness of God's creatures. Belief in God is to love one's fellow men. For putting these dangerous ideas into practice, the gentle British held him for a total of 30 years, one-third of his life, serving various prison terms, most of it in solitary confinement, usually under a charge of sedition. When World War II broke out, Gandhi did not want to repeat his mistake of the First World War. This time, he offered to support the British only if they would promise independence after the war. They declined, and he continued his campaign, for which he spent 2 years in prison. After the war, facing further disruption, the British agreed to independence in 1947. But the terms of independence were a disappointment to Gandhi, since they divided the Muslims and Hindus into Pakistan and India. This is the issue over which he was assassinated in January 1948 by a fanatical Hindu who feared that his nonviolent approach would give too much away to the Muslims. While Gandhi is remembered by the nation he created, his teachings are not followed. His closest collaborator, Jawaharlal Nehru, leading the newly independent India, quickly responded to challenges from Pakistan on the border, China from Tibet, and Portugal in Goa, by building a militarized Indian state. But the enduring importance of Gandhi in the world was that he demonstrated in pragmatic steps how nonviolence could work. Nowhere did he have a greater impact than in the United States.
And the next section of the tape you're listening to, it's called Nonviolence, 25 Lessons in Nonviolence by Mark Kurlansky. I'm going to play that, I think, on Sunday when I play a longer version, or actually I do a longer version of this show. So I invite you to come on back then or check out the book yourself. Again, it's a book by Mark Kurlansky, K-U-R-L-A-N-S-K-Y, who's written on a number of subjects, and some very interesting things to say about this. He writes a lot of interesting stuff. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM is what you're listening to. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. The call-in number, 427-3772. And I believe we have working phones, and I believe, yeah, the ringers are on full bell in case anybody wants to call in. And let's have a little musical break, and then I'll be back with some more exciting adventures and possibly some comments from you.
2 million bushels of North African grain, resold to Germany for Swiss francs, paid for by a consortium of banks with a deal in futures at the stock exchange, unloads for coffee from Brazilian uplands, destined for Paris before the whole deal sinks. The checks written in indelible inks out race Atlantics, winter hurricanes, at last the coffee arrives, also the wheat. Needless to say, the deal was a success. Who can deny that all of us have gained? Our benefactors, three trusts, they compete for honor, glory, power, and of course, profits, where all happiness is contained. North African grain, resold to Germany for Swiss francs, paid for by a consortium of banks with a deal in futures that the stock exchange unloads for coffee from Brazilian uplands, destined for Paris before the whole deal sinks. The checks written in indelible inks out race Atlantics, winter hurricanes, at last the coffee arrives, also the wheat. Needless to say, the deal was a success. Who can deny that all of us have gained? Our benefactors, three trusts, they compete for honor, glory, power, and of course, profits, where all happiness is contained.
And that was Business, another Broadside song, sung by Pete Seeger. And it's... That's a Pete Seeger song. I guess that's all I need to say about that, or all I want to. Let's whip into a few interviews, and then I'm going to do a couple of updates. There has been recent controversy and activism up in Portland, Oregon, as activists up there fight to maintain public access to the sidewalks, and city business interests and politicians seek to restrict it, sort of similar to what they do here in Santa Cruz. I'll be reading a story or two about that, plus an attempt to shut down Middletown Food Not Bombs. I assume that's Middletown, Connecticut, but I could be wrong. It's not quite clear which state it's from. But again, food servers are being pursued by politicians and conservative business interests, it looks like, with an eye to... Again, removing activists from public spaces so as to clamp down, calm down, freeze down, or maintain the illusion of calm, peace, and everything is beautiful on the streets and sidewalks of America, even as people's houses are foreclosed on, people lose work, and a prisoner dies every week in the California prison system through no health treatment, no inadequate health care there, which has resulted in the prison system being put into receivership, and still the prisoners are essentially being sacrificed on the altar of money as the legislature and the governor refuse to obey the federal courts. That's something that's happening. You can see it in the back columns of the San Francisco Chronicle. Sometimes even makes it into the Sentinel. Anyway, let's listen to a few street interviews.
Justin Trousseau abandoned his post. He's got his guitar on wheels and he's munching a pepperoni. Cal, what's cooking for the musicians downtown?
Oh man, I don't know. It's really rough down here now. There's either too many of them and too many of crappy musicians. Just makes people just walk right by. They really should have some kind of law that you got to do some kind of audition or something around here before you can break your instrument out.
Now, how many hours a day have you been on the mall plunking?
All day.
And how much money have you made?
Today I've worked about 3 hours and made $5. Yesterday was worse. About it was a whole lot worse.
But no hassles from police?
No, huh?
Because I just heard of a case of Officer Winston pursuing a guy down the street, telling him he had alcohol in his breath, and demanding he leave the mall, even though he wasn't drunk and he didn't have an open container. So make sure you fly straight and teetotal at all times.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, sorry to hear it, and may the pizza be with you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. All right, well, I'm here at about 10 to 3, munching down in front of New Leaf's store here on Pacific Avenue in the fenced-off area between the two cafes, Campesino and Alfresco, talking with
Lawrence McGregor.
And, Lawrence, I know you... there was a little, I guess, action and hubbub last night because you had a stroke on the street, right?
Yes, sir.
Tell me what happened there.
I heard about my mom passing away. I've been having a lot of stress all day because my bike got stolen. And now the hospital didn't treat me anywhere near the way they're supposed to treat a person. They keep on asking me, are you on drugs? Are you on this? Are you on that? And I told him, you took so much blood on me, why can't you just check the blood? They wouldn't do it. They kept on asking me, and I started having seizures again.
How long were you? This is a Dominican?
Yeah.
How long were you in Dominican?
Since 7 o'clock last night till almost 10:45 this morning.
And did you need to stay longer? Did they discharge you early, or did you want to leave?
I just wanted to leave because they gave me so much attitude, and I don't like attitudes.
Now, you're homeless.
Yes.
And you think that, you suspect that might have been a reason for it, or do you think there's some other reason?
I really don't know. It might be because I'm homeless, not having a place to live, but it's that their choice of giving me stress at the hospital.
So, what about your physical condition? How are you feeling now?
I feel like my chest just wants to close up again, and not knowing what to do.
Now, have you had a stroke before? Or is this your first stroke?
This is my first stroke.
And did you get? Are you suffering any paralysis as a result? Or
I don't know what that means. So
I paralysis means you can't move some part of your body, or
my left hand. If I lean on it too long, my arm starts numbing up, my shoulder starts numbing up, and my chest feels like it just wants to close up.
You also have some sleeping tickets you're going to take care of, right? Or there was a, I guess did you talk to Becky Johnson, the Huff activist? Do you have a court date yet for that? What's happening with that?
I don't know. I don't have anything. No, cops ain't telling me I have a warrant or anything.
How many times have you been busted or ticketed for sleeping?
About 5.
And you're sleeping outside still?
Yes, sir.
Where do you, if you feel like saying it, do you usually sleep? Or where were you getting these tickets?
One ticket I got, it was out of the city limits. It was about 5, maybe 6 miles out of city limits. I still got a ticket there. Rangers.
Right.
I got a ticket here in town off the levee. Nowhere else to sleep. I got a ticket over by the Red Church. And all the other ones are over by the beach.
What have you heard about the Greek church? About a year ago, you know, folks used to sleep on the porch of the Greek church across from the main library down there at the Civic.
Don't know anything about it.
I know they had a Greek festival there, and I was having a kind of a critical conversation with one of the Greek... Actually, he wasn't a local pastor, but he was kind of a guy from Cyprus visiting, and he had on a kind of a Greek religious outfit, and I was, you know, wondering what was going on with... Now, they're making a lot of money, or they're trying to make money with their little Greek festival, but what about poor people that Christianity is supposedly primarily concerned with? So, well, Lawrence, any final words? I see you've still got some fans on the street there.
I have a bunch of friends and family because everyone found out about me going to the hospital last night. They thought I was going to have a heart attack, found out it was a stroke. And I had like 4 people at the hospital waiting for me there.
Well, that's great, man.
It was good.
So, did they come back this morning to help you, or?
No, because they went to work. I still have a little bit of sling and slung. My speech is going
slurred speech.
Yeah, I can't pronounce things that well anymore.
You still sound pretty good. I mean, maybe a little slow at some points, but you sound okay. Doesn't sound unusual. I didn't notice you had slurred speech.
Well, I'm glad you stopped to talk to me. We'll pass this on to Free Radio. Any final message for folks out there?
Yeah, just watch out for the cops. They won't want to help. They want to give out tickets.
But you did get some help from the ambulance last night?
Yeah. They didn't have no cops there. They only had an ambulance and a fire department. That's it.
I remember seeing three squad cars lined up around the time. Well, and Lawrence is being greeted by another associate on the street. Thank you, Lawrence. So I'm talking to an individual who wishes to remain anonymous who's talked about an August 14th incident near the boardwalk where security guards jacked him up, pulled him by the hair, seized his cell phone, and proceeded to... in front of Mama San's Liquors, and apparently, according to the individual I'm talking to here, he told me they mistook him for someone else who was stealing a bracelet whom they later caught, and the original name of the guard who hassled him was Mata, and Wes Walker was also involved, apparently, the security guard chief, according to our the man who was giving me this account. How long were you held? Says he was held 20 minutes till the guard showed up. Were you held in handcuffs? Says he was. You were assaulted. What way were you assaulted? Five security guards. Were any police officers involved? No police officers. And about what time of day was this?
5 o'clock in the afternoon.
And how long have you been in Santa Cruz? I mean, has this kind of thing happened to you before, or have you seen it happen to anyone else? Now you're managed. You got your flip flops on. You got shorts. But you're a
musician.
You're a student. And what kind of music do you play?
Free jams, man. Smooth jams.
Guitar?
Yeah, guitar, piano. Vocal.
Now, I should warn you that your voice is now on tape. That's okay. So, you're looking for a lawyer, but you've been unsuccessful in finding one.
Not totally.
So maybe you have found one. So there actually may be some action on this. You weren't given a citation or arrested. Just a false. Now, did they tell you were under arrest? What did they? There was none of that. And you were. What kind of dialogue happened between you and them?
Well, the guy accused me of some things, and I told him to smoke some crack, and I left. Continued on my walk.
After 20 minutes.
Yeah. Well, no, that happened later. 10 minutes later. He came up and decided that his boss needed to assault me.
So the original contact was with this guy Mata, you say. Is that correct?
Yeah.
The original contact was a guy called Mata?
Yeah.
And what exactly did he do with you? What was the nature of your interaction?
Accusations.
What did he accuse you of?
Stealing a bracelet from some lady, 6 boxes in the opposite direction I was coming from.
Your response was?
It wasn't me.
His response was?
Yeah, it was.
And then what happened?
And then I told him he needs to stop accusing me. He told me he was accusing me of some things. And he said he wasn't. So I continued on with my day. I said, well, have a good day. He said, you're not welcome here. I said, I'm not here. I'm going across the street to continue the liquor store and get a beer.
And then the more serious part of the incident occurred?
Well, I walked across the street and he said, that's our property too. I continued walking, ignoring him, and went to the liquor store. I was about to walk into the liquor store and the director of security walked up to me and said that he was going to detain me because I was a suspect in a theft case, apparently.
Did he claim he was detaining you because he needed to bring in an eyewitness to either confirm or deny your identity, or just for the hell of it, or did he give you any reason?
It seemed that they were going to get an eyewitness, but nobody ever showed up. Across their security radios, they detained two other individuals, said they had long hair and a skateboard, pulled them up too. I was pretty irate. I was pissed off because they were just being assholes.
And what manner did they detain you? How were you detained? Were you handcuffed?
Two of them grabbed me by the side of my arms, and I told them they weren't going to fuck with me. They're not going to lock me up and fucking tackle me to the ground. And I held my ground. And when the one in front of me said that I wasn't going to leave anywhere, I put my hands behind my back and let him put me in cuffs. After that, they grabbed me by my hair and fucking grabbed me by my arms and decided they were going to set me down. And I told them to fuck off. I sat down on my own on the corner and said, fucking call the police. You guys have my phone. I can't call my lawyer. Let's get something handled. So they called the cops. Officer Jones showed up from Santa Cruz Police Department and said, well, pretty much asked me my information. I gave him the same information I gave the security guards. And told him to let me out of cuffs. He took my picture and let me out of cuffs.
Did Jones... How quickly after Jones arrived did he let you out of the cuffs?
5 minutes.
And Was that at your request or at his own initiative?
Well, the man, Wes Walker, was going through my cell phone at the time, and I asked the officer if that was a violation of my civil rights for him to be going through my cell phone, my personal numbers, my private life, over some instance that definitely had nothing to do with my cell phone. So.
And what was Jones' response?
He didn't really give me a solid response. He said something along the lines of maybe. That's when the guy gave me back my cell phone.
So the guy became perhaps a little nervous that he was, in fact, violating your rights and he might be held accountable?
Yeah, definitely. And even more so when the cop released me from cuffs, I tried to get everyone's name that was involved in the situation, and they said he couldn't have it. He gave me his card, and that's it. And I read the Mata's name who initiated the incident.
So were you, his did name you have any neutral witnesses who were there, who observed, who were concerned?
I had two.
They were friends or people you just didn't know?
Associates. Two associates. Well known. I've known for
And what was their reaction to this as it was happening?
They told him it wasn't me. They knew it wasn't me. And one of them left because he had fucking business to take care of. He couldn't be held up by the police officers. Not really police officers. And my other friend just walked up and watched the whole incident after I had been placed in cuffs.
Were you injured or in any way?
No, I wasn't injured. I had cuff prints on my wrists. I had scars on my wrists.
For how long?
Just the afternoon, you know.
Mm-hmm. And how about, did you feel that you suffered any pain and humiliation in the sense that you were being treated as a criminal? It sounds like that's what angered you.
I was still annoyed about it. It's quite obviously an annoying fucking thing to have to think about every day. I walk through that place every fucking day to go to band practice, to go see my associates, go see my friends. I live in this town, so it's like these guys want to act like a gang and want to act like there's some Crips and walking up on me and going to beat me down because I'm wearing the wrong hat, you know? It's fucked up.
You're a long hair, man. We don't want your kind around here.
Quite obviously.
Right.
So.
Any advice to folks dealing with the security police of the boardwalk? I should say the insecurity police.
I don't know. Watch your manners. Even then, they're probably going to fuck with you, so... And your business. Don't break any elbows. I didn't break any elbows.
How long have you been a resident of Santa Cruz?
3 years now. 3 years.
Any other problems here, or this is the first time this has happened to you?
No. No other problems. People are cool. People are relaxed.
No problems on the mall?
No.
Anything you want to say to your fans out there in free radio land?
Nah, man.
Be loved. You're welcome to give your name or not as you wish.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you, man. Talking with?
Oh, Renee.
And Renee, you're here in front of Borders about 3:05 with a blue table with some chairs. Luckily, they're at least more than 10 feet away from the change-making machine and more than 10 feet away from the building. What are you doing here?
I am distributing burritos and pastries and fresh baked goods that my daughter made and water.
Has Ryan Coonerty attempted to talk some sense into you today?
Not today.
What about the chip of the Downtown Association?
You know what? They're actually really cool to me. We've made friends with them all, and they're great. They come by and talk to us.
What about the lady on the second floor of Borders? She come down and hassled you, perhaps?
No, nobody hassles us.
Well, I could hassle you if you'd like.
All right.
I already got a tape recorder stuck in your face.
They haven't hassled us so far.
So, yeah, it looks like you're running out of... You got a few sandwiches and pastries here, I see, in your backpack.
No sandwiches, just pastries, freshly made burritos we made this morning.
Just some sort of thing, something about the dentist, you're trying to get the dentist more business in our town?
No, we're just trying to reach the homeless community with God's love, and we believe that the way to do that is to be kind, and they're hungry, and they're not starving, but you know, they're hungry enough to want our burritos.
Don't you realize this only encourages their drug habits?
I'm not going to try to fix their life. I'm just going to try to show them God's unconditional love. God,
enabler. So, what's happening at Calvary Episcopal? Is there still a coffee house every Monday night?
I hear there is. That's the word on the street.
And have you heard any good things about it since you left, which is, a couple months ago?
I think the youth community is happy to be getting food.
And is there still a prohibition against lingering on the lawn of the church at 6 days a week?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that the homeless youth community is welcome to hang around there.
What do you notice about the downtown area in terms of the police and the hosts? Better, worse, the same?
Well, they're really pleasant to me. I'm not coming from the perspective of a homeless person or homeless youth, so they have a different opinion about it than I do.
What about the accounts you're hearing from some of the folks who take your food?
They feel harassed.
More so than before, do you think? Less so? Any feeling about that, whether there's an increase or decrease?
Definitely an increase. They're, chasing everybody around town. But like my good friend Paulie says, the world is round. And I just am glad to have them here, because if they weren't here, I wouldn't be able to know them.
Okay. Again, we've been talking with that mystical thinker, Rane, how can people reach you if they want to give you stuff or contribute to your campaign to no or to yes the homeless in this case?
My email is missronee2@comcast.net.
Fair enough, and thank you, and keep up the sweet work.
Oh, God bless you, Robert. You
and,
too.
And may humanity be with you. So I'm here with
Cole Sadler.
Cole, you whipped out a yellow piece of paper, the familiar Santa Cruz Police Department notice to appear. And you've gotten us sitting on the sidewalk within 14 feet of a directory sign.
Yeah, that's their base. That's the basis. If you sit 14, they can use a directory sign because they can't just outlaw sitting on the sidewalk unequivocally. So they have to outlaw sitting within a specific distance. And 14 feet is actually the squares on the sidewalk.
Seven squares.
Yes. Yeah, basically.
So this is, it looks like a ticket from June 25th. It looks like it's our old friend, Bill Winston, badge 164.
Is that the guy who licks his chops like a wolf all the time?
Winston is a short fellow, peppery, outspoken.
Certainly that.
And frequent on the mall. He also has been accused of violence on a couple of occasions, and was there a violent incident up here recently? No smiling downtown, ma'am. I'm sorry.
It is against the law now. They will ticket you.
So can you want to tell me more about this citation, how it happened?
Well, you see, Robert, I was homeless, years ago, back in 2005, and the only reason I'm paying my rent now is because I have student loans from the university that I can pay my rent with. And the thing was, I was on the street one day, and there were these folk punk girls who were moving through town, and they were playing on the sidewalk. And after giving them some apples and carrots that I had bought at New Leaf, I stood to listen to them while they were sitting. And then the cops came by, licking their chop. Like, what's the officer's name?
Officer Winston.
Officer Winston, and a friend of his, kind of a younger, taller, chubbier.
Warren. Perhaps.
Probably. Warren walked by, and they're watching these girls. Winston's licking his chops like a wolf. They hand the girls the brochure telling them what all their rights were on the street.
Their forbidden zones, what their non-rights are.
Yeah, their non-rights are. Yeah, exactly. And I, so they come back, and they're like being very condescending. They said, well, girls, you break the law in Santa Cruz, it's the law. We have to give you a ticket. So finally, I can't take it anymore, and I've been itching to do some civil disobedience against these unjust laws. And I have the money to pay for a ticket, to be honest. And a lot of these kids can't. A lot of these kids skip town afterwards and whatnot. They can't come back. So I say, I actually said this too, this is the funny part, in the face of unjust laws, it is incumbent upon good men to violate them. To which the cops turn around and say, well, if you violate them, we'll give you a ticket. To which I respond, well, I'm not poor like these kids you're harassing. I could actually pay for it. Give me a ticket. Now, here's the interesting part. They refused to give me a ticket until I absolutely made them, whereas the other young people I was talking to that day, they would just go up and hand them tickets, and they weren't even doing anything illegal. They'd just say, you're being unproductive. Here's a ticket. But for me, they warned me repeatedly. They said, we can't give you a ticket. I said, well, I'm dissenting against you in my mind. Give me a ticket. They responded, you'd have to sit on the sidewalk. I sat on the sidewalk.
Now, was there a performance going on at this time?
No, the girls had stopped stop playing.
If you sit on the sidewalk while there's a performance going on, 14-foot rule does not apply.
Well, there was a performance going on, and they told the girls to stop performing and go away, basically.
And what was their pretext for doing so?
Oh, the sitting on the sidewalk thing.
You can sit on the sidewalk if they're 14 feet out of a building. Were they 14 feet away?
It's the municipal sign that's the marker point.
So they weren't 14 feet from the sign.
No, 14 squares. Not even really feet. It's 14 of these squares.
No, it's 7 of those squares.
Seven of the squares?
Those are 2 feet each.
Oh, because it says here 14 squares on my ticket. Either way.
Let's take a look at this.
Let's take a look.
Again.
I believe 14...
feet.
Okay,
that's
feet.
That's a foot sign.
14 feet, okay. So 14 feet of municipal sign. They were within. It was actually right over there by the director's
sign. Well, they were criminals, and you were consorting with them. I mean, let's admit it here.
Yes, actually, that's what I told them repeatedly. I'm a criminal. Give me a ticket.
You have a black hat on. I mean, and look at you. You're all in black.
Yeah.
One of those goth types.
Yeah.
You got suspenders, no belts, which is interesting. And on top of that, you have a number of buttons. I don't see an IWW button, though. Looks like different groups of some kind.
Punk rock bands, man.
Monkey, schmunky groups.
Criminal.
So you're beyond your time as far as getting... This ticket probably has appeared. It's probably gone to...
I called them repeatedly. I called them immediately afterwards because I planned to go to court and challenge it and condemn them from the pulpit, but they haven't processed it yet. I called
still?
Them. Yes, still. It's been, I called them in
July,
within 30
August,
days. Then they told,
2.5 months.
They told me to call them again in August, and I did call them in August, and once again they said that it hasn't been processed and that I have to call them every month for the next year before it'll get dropped. So their bureaucracy is so bad that that they just haven't even processed it yet. And I've been waiting. I'm waiting. When am I going to go to court, you know? And so I guess to end the story about how I got the ticket as well, when I sat down on the sidewalk, they said, sir, I'm obliged to warn you that if you do not stand up right now, I'll be forced to give you a ticket. So I gestured at them, give it to me.
Bring it on.
Yeah, bring it on. They also, here's where I'm disappointed in myself. Because they told me that if I were to get another ticket within 48 hours, I would go to jail. And I really, you know, I was really considering it because I believe, once again, it's a civil disobedience. I'm against this law. I'm no different than the people they're persecuting, except I happen to get student loans for rent.
I don't know where they get the 48 hours. It's within 6 months, I believe.
Really?
Yeah, so in other words, you do it again, it's a misdemeanor. I don't know if it's clear if it's discretionary or if it's mandatory, but that's the code.
I think it's discretionary. Because I know a lot of kids were getting multiple tickets in one day and not being arrested.
Well, the police may be ignoring the mandatory aspect of the law because they do not want to charge a misdemeanor. A misdemeanor means a jury trial, public defender.
It means Supreme Court. It means, well, it could be appeals process would get it to at least the state Supreme Court, where the state Supreme Court has shown that they are sympathetic.
The police, even as we speak.
Exactly. The Supreme Court has shown themselves to be sympathetic to the plight of the homeless in striking down sleeping bans in other cities.
And let's be honest, that's not quite accurate, but at least on one occasion that happened, the Jones decision in Los Angeles, and that influenced a number of other city councils. Now, I don't want people to think that if they appeal their ticket, they're going to get the sleeping ban thrown out. Although, I would love to see them appeal their tickets.
Yeah, I think we need to move it up to the higher courts. We need to show that Santa Cruz, which claims to be a bastion...
Once you purge the higher courts of people like Roberts, our Supreme Court Chief Justice...
Scalia.
Kennedy. Thomas. It's a group of scumbag, white privileged characters who...
Appointed by Bush, both of them.
Well, you've also got the Obama crew. The recent Obama appointee is not a hell of a lot better. She was a prosecutor, and she's pretty horrible, but nobody really talks about it.
Sotomayor, yeah. Well, you know, Obama is probably going to be no better or worse than Clinton in many ways. Clinton being Alan Greenspan's favorite Republican president.
Well, as well as the fact that Obama has intensified the war in Pakistan and Afghanistan and has actually got more combined contractors and troops in Iraq than was there before.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to say that the war crimes continue and intensify under our Führer.
Yeah, the new Messiah, I think, more.
He, remember, you have to have the audacity of...
Ooh, ooh, ooh. I know, with the face looking up and the shining light.
It's very shining, particularly if you get those bombs exploding, but keep out of range.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I'm glad to tell you about this ticket I got, because I wish that I had been, I actually wish I had done it again just so they would have arrested me, because I could tell that the officer who gave me the ticket was really itching to arrest me. He gave me several nasty looks afterward, because he knew that I embarrassed him by making him give a non-homeless person a ticket. And several people came up afterwards and said, why'd you get a ticket? I told them it was illegal. These are tourists. I told them it was illegal to sit on the sidewalk and do a number of other things like play hacky sack and blow bubbles in Santa Cruz, to which they're like, really?
Bubbles is actually allowed. Hacky sack is not.
Really? I heard that bubbles will get you ticketed because of putting something in the air.
It's true, but the bubbles are an exception. I will show you the code section.
Really? I didn't know that. That's what I
actually had to make an exception. Actually, also, juggling and bubbles are an exception. Juggling was an exception that was created a year later after one guy went to jail for juggling and threatened to bring a bunch of jugglers to town, which frightened Mike Rotkin, council member, into calling an emergency law into effect that, in fact, legalized juggling on Pacific Avenue. So you'll see jugglers occasionally.
Now, have you met Savage and Mike and his little crew of jugglers that just recently came
to
town? Yeah, they're great, and I'm glad they've actually not been harassed by the cops, probably because they're loath to harass jugglers. And I think they're great, and if you see them on the street, you know, you should say hi.
I will.
Give them some love.
Fair enough. Well, I want to thank you, and again, we've been talking with
Cole Sadler.
Thank you, Cole.
And you're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Call in number 427-3772. You want to contact the radio station itself, you can get the voicemail by calling 427-4523, 427-4523. Leave a question, leave a public service announcement, I don't know, leave a nasty comment, your choice. If you want to actually become a part of Free Radio, possibly get your own show, you can download an application on our website, freakradio.org. Check it out. Or you can send us a substantial check to our snail mail address, Free Radio Santa Cruz, Post Office Box 7507, Santa Cruz, 95061. And if you want any of those numbers, again, just remember one number, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. That's my home phone number and also the number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. I'm told that the message has been changed. I don't know if somebody's been sneaking into my phone there. But again, 423-HUFF is the number to call. I will get back to you if you can leave me a message. And if you've got any questions about anything you've heard on the show, if you want to be on my show, if you haven't heard a number that you want to have repeated off the air so I can give it to you again, just give a call. Let's have a brief musical break. I'll be back, and I'll talk to you some more.
Time you pick up a newspaper, every time you switch on the TV, you can bet your old boots that at some point you'll see a high-ranking copper or Tory MP calling on all who are British and free to stand up and defend law and order. It's illegal to rip off a payroll, it's illegal to hold up a train, but it's legal to rip off a million or two that comes from the labor that other folk do. To plunder the many on behalf of the few is a thing that is perfectly legal. It's illegal to kill off a landlord or to trespass upon his estate, but to charge a high rent for a slum is okay. To condemn two adults and three children to stay in a hovel that's rotten with damp and decay is a thing that is perfectly legal. If your job turns you into a zombie, it's legal to feel some despair, but don't be aggressive, that is, if you're smart, and for Christ's sake, don't upset the old apple cart. Remember your interests at heart, and it grieves him to see you unhappy. If you fashion a bomb in the kitchen, you're guilty of breaking the law. But a bloody great nuclear plant is okay, though plutonium processing hastens the day when this tight little isle may be blasted away. Nonetheless, it is perfectly legal. It's illegal if you are a gypsy to camp by the side of the road. But it's proper and right for the rich and the great to live in the mansion and own an estate that was got from the people by pillage and rape. That's what they call a tradition. It's illegal to carve up your missus
or put poison in your old man's tea.
But poison the rivers, the seas and the skies, and poison the mind of the nation with lies. If it's done in the interests of free enterprise, then it's proper and perfectly legal. It's legal to join a trade union, and to picket is one of your rights. But don't be offensive when scabs cross the line. Be nice to the coppers and keep this in mind. To picket effectively, that is a crime. Worse than if you had murdered your mother. It's legal to sing on the telly, but they make bloody sure that you don't. If you sing about racists and fascists and creeps and thieves in high places who live off the weak and those who are selling us right up the creek, the twisters, the takers, the con men, the fakers, the whole bloody gang of exploiters.
And that's Legal Illegal, a song by one of my favorite singing duos, Peggy Seeger and her old lover, Ewan McCall, and fellow performer. McCall's been dead many years. Seeger's still around. And their son, Callum McCall, was on guitar. It's from the album Hot Blast, although you heard it also from the CD from the Broadside collection. Some of the notes are interesting. What is legal is not necessarily just, and what is just may not be legal. This song highlights the way people in power determine that certain things cannot be done, while even worse things are legal. Ewan McCall, 1915 to 1989, born Jimmy Miller, was a Scots folk singer, actor, playwright, musicologist, and songwriter. McCall grew up in Lancashire, England, where he learned many traditional songs from the family. He started working as a laborer and mechanic when he was just 14, hence the strong union support that manifested itself in his songs over the years. After moving to London in the 1950s, Ewan became one of the most important figures in the emerging British folk song revival. He founded the Ballads and Blues Club, later renamed the Singers Club, and promoted folk music in Britain. One of McCall's most significant contributions was his 1957 collaboration with his wife, Peggy Seeger, who's Pete Seeger's half-sister, by the way, and Charles Parker on the BBC series The Radio Ballads. McCall also wrote scripts for television and films, and with Peggy compiled a number of influential folk song anthologies, and so forth and so on. In 1962, McCall was refused a visa to enter the United States because of his political leanings, an event that caused great uproar in the folk music community. Editorials were written in Broadside condemning the government's act, and he eventually was allowed to come. Of the more than 300 songs he composed, his love song for Peggy, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, is one of his most famous, winning a Grammy Award in 1973 for Song of the Year, and has been recorded by many. Ewan's daughter, Christy, is a recording artist, as are his sons, Neil and Callum. And Peggy Seeger, born in New York City to a musical family, father Charles, mother Ruth Crawford, were eminent musicologists. Pete Seeger, as mentioned before, her half-brother. During her childhood, her parents worked on compiling anthologies of folk songs, so she was exposed to countless traditional tunes. Starting with a piano, she gradually learned to play a host of folk instruments, and She started joined the folk group The Ramblers, which included Ewan McCall, in 1956. They started performing as a duo, were married 2 years later, and I just love her music, particularly her early political songs like this one, which is just snappy, sharp, witty, and piercing as well. So, I hope you like it. Let's see here. Well, I like to think of myself as being concerned with local issues. There's an editorial in the Santa Cruz Sentinel, or the Urinal, as I like to call it. Gosh, it was yesterday, day before yesterday. Wham Fest Smoking. Wham Fest is an event in which the Women and Men for Medical Marijuana, a longtime collective in Santa Cruz, run by the Corrals, which serves a small number of, a couple hundred people, but small compared to the number of people who need to be served in Santa Cruz with medical marijuana. They have a special kind of privileged status in the community government. The city government actually helped them give away medical marijuana to 7 of their patients in a public demonstration of support on the steps of City Hall back in 2002, which I thought was just fine. I'm all for that, except it's the same city council that essentially shut down all clubs for 5 years by passing very restrictive zoning laws. And between 2000 and 2005, we had no clubs and not a peep, generally, out of Valerie or Mike Corral and Wham on the subject, which pissed me off big time. I always get annoyed when people in positions of power who can speak are silent. People who are, have the benefit of some political punch choose to simply sort of rest on their laurels or enjoy their own privileges. But I certainly support, Wham's having a yearly event where people can smoke in the park. It's too bad that Wham doesn't support the right to medicate with marijuana the rest of the time for those who have medical needs under circumstances where other people don't have to breathe their smoke, but still without being harassed by the police. And we have people like Craig Canada, who we've talked about on the show, and we've talked to him. He has his own website, palmspringsbum.org, if you want to check his interesting saga as a homeless man, largely homeless, he contends, because he could not get lodging because he's candid about his medical marijuana use, which he finds is important for his health. And in Santa Cruz, although we're supposed to be the big medical marijuana town, he got repeatedly hassled for it by the police because he was homeless, and then when he wasn't homeless as well. So the issue, the smoking, of course, has become a big issue. Smoking generally, smoking of anything, smoking of tobacco is, of course, the main concern. It's coming up for a second reading at City Council, a proposed law that would make smoking on Pacific Avenue, I think it's Bay Street, and also, is it Westcliff, completely illegal, and on the street and on the sidewalks. It's not entirely clear if it means they'll arrest you if you smoke in your car, although if you actually read the wording of the law, that could be the case. And when I talked to one of the task force members, Councilmember Don Lane, who put together the law, he wasn't clear on whether you could be arrested for that or not. I've pointed out before on the show that going after people who smoke in public places as a sort of a blank check to the police means that they will be able to clear homeless people out of the area. Homeless people, it's my impression, have a much higher percentage of smokers, tobacco smokers, and maybe marijuana smokers, for all I know. Although marijuana is more expensive, obviously. Though tobacco is getting more expensive, too. It's a way of, for example, driving homeless people out of San Lorenzo Park, creating a pretext to go over and arrest them, or I should say search their belongings, interrogate them, even if it's just simply being there, having a cigarette in an area that is bothering no one, where the smoke can't possibly reach people who are hundreds of feet away. I've talked on this show about the problems of determining the lack of clarity about whether secondhand smoke outside has been definitively shown to be a health hazard. Let's say, compared, let's say, with automobile exhausts or other problems. And it's just, I'm not yet persuaded. I mean, I'm open to that kind of argument. You know, I'm not a smoker. I don't like smoking. Kiss someone who's a smoker and you sometimes feel like you're kissing an ashtray. And my nose is particularly sensitive to, I can smell an ashtray from across the room. It's icky, man, let's face it. But some people are addicted to nicotine. Some people choose to do that. And provided they're not blowing it in your face, why should there be a law which criminalizes them from doing it? I've always felt there should be a consensual interaction between people on these issues. That is to say, if you don't like them smoking, say, you know, can you move that cigarette over somewhere else? Not, hey, there's a no smoking sign, hey, you know, as though it somehow everyone should immediately hustle and rustle like little lemmings to follow the little laws that someone has posted, regardless of what anyone else in the vicinity wants done, and regardless of common sense in the situation. It also gives the police far too much power. Anyway, this editorial in the Sentinel, I think it's attacking the Wham Fest. It says, City of Santa Cruz recently approved an extensive smoking ban for downtown, the municipal wharf, and all city parks. The issue of what to do about the annual medical marijuana Wham Fest September 26th in San Lorenzo Park has drifted this way like unwelcome secondhand smoke. Last year, we argued that while we support the use of marijuana in alleviating suffering and pain, allowing marijuana puffing on public property seemed to go against smoking bans that had already been adopted. After waffling on the issue, city leaders finally let the smoking and toking proceed. Now, with the far more extensive ban, the city finds itself in an uncomfortable spot, supporting marijuana use for medical purposes, but on record that marijuana smoke is part of the new regulations. Either secondhand smoke is dangerous to people's health or it isn't. The Women and Men's Alliance for Medical Marijuana, which sponsors the celebration, should give the council an out by restricting any medicinal smoking to enclosed tents or other such structures. You know, it seems to me that, well, with respect to medical marijuana, again, we're talking outdoors on the grass for one day. I believe that if you have to medicate, if you have a medical need to medicate, you should not be prevented from doing so by a sort of a blanket restriction at any time, particularly on the one day where people can voluntarily come to this event or not as they wish. It seems pretty obvious to me. It'd be interesting, however, to go online and see what the local right-wing renegades think about this. You go to the Sentinel website, you often find some pretty weird stuff. And sometimes you can't find the right website. Let's see if I can find it over here. I'm running from computer to computer. And again, I'm inviting folks to call in if you have any thoughts of your own you want to pass on the air. You've got a chance. I'll be on the air for another 40 minutes. Let's see if we can get a hold of this article and see what's happening. The actual Santa Cruz smoking ban does not go into effect until a month from next Tuesday, if it, as I assume it will, passes a second reading at the Santa Cruz City Council. Now, I asked Don Lane lots of questions about this issue. He's one of the council members who pushed the ban, and he sent me some notes which are unreadable. So I've sent him back an email saying, help me out here and, you know, send me something I can read. And who knows, he may do that, and maybe on Sunday I can give you some more information. Let's see here. Wham asks for smoking exception again. Now this should be a little some dickering on this subject. Aha, 176 comments if you go online is what you find. And what do we got here? Well, we have a hard time actually reading what's online, but I will find it and do it. Let's see. Okay. you have the same kind of comments I find when people are talking about criticizing us for urging the city to overturn its anti-homeless sleeping ban, the law that makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep legally somewhere, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere at night. Why don't Mike and Valerie, those are the corrals who head Wham, just invite all these people to their marijuana garden and sit around there and smoke themselves to death? You don't need them doing so in town in violation of the law, polluting the air for all those who don't want to inhale their secondhand smoke. Well, again, it's only in one spot. It's on San Lorenzo Park. You don't have to go over there at that particular time of day. And I just see this as a sort of a paranoid insistence on forcing everyone else to do what, you know, you think should be done, simply because it's your feeling. But perhaps this caller will have a different perspective. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Yeah, Robert, I just listened to your show. I listen from time to time. I just thought I'd let you know that there's an article on the web, I believe it's on Slate, that addresses this exact issue about the effects of secondhand smoke outdoors. And it's got a lot of scientific data on there, and if you scroll down to the bottom of the article, it basically says don't bother passing laws against smoking outdoors because it's not worth it. So I just thought I'd let you know that there is an article about that.
Sure, and you've read the article.
Yeah.
I haven't read it yet, and I probably won't have time to read it before the show ends. What is Slate?
Slate is slate.com. That is a website that has generally a political bent toward their news, and they have various columnists who write about the topics of the day. I think Christopher Hitchens is one of their feature columnists, but I think it's owned by the Washington Post, and it's sort of like Salon.com. But
yeah.
I think that same article is also on ABC.com or something like that.
What's are you a smoker yourself?
No, I'm not. I'm an ex-smoker. It doesn't really, the issue of smoking is not, the largest priority in my life right now. But
yeah, I actually had that same comment from Steve Argue, an activist who has spoken up on a lot of issues but doesn't think this is a particularly big issue. I'm concerned about it as it affects homeless people and expands police power in Santa Cruz.
I agree, absolutely. I think that, for one thing, don't make a law that you can't enforce. They're going to have to use selective enforcement on it. It's just like bicycles or skateboards going the wrong way down Pacific Avenue. Once in a while they'll target somebody for that offense, but the vast majority of people who do it never get a ticket for it. So for the smoking ordinance, it's going to be the same thing. They'll have to selectively enforce it.
Yeah, of course they have no problem with selective enforcement because that's sort of their middle name as far as these laws that make it illegal to sit down on the sidewalk and so forth. What's your impression reading this article? There is a study or two which talks about the harmful effects of secondhand smoke outdoors. And when I talked to Councilmember Lane, he seemed to feel there was some pretty persuasive evidence. Have you researched this subject any further, caller?
No, I haven't researched it at all. Actually, I just read the one article, but it was, as I remember it, I think I read it yesterday, but it does have a lot of citing of statistics and studies that have been done by different universities, and he spends a lot of time saying that, yes, that in certain circumstances, secondhand smoke outdoors can be a problem, but it's in highly specific circumstances where you have to be practically standing right next to the smoker. But in something, as you were saying, in San Lorenzo Park, when you're 200 feet away from the nearest person, it's not going to be a problem. And that was the basic conclusion of his article, that if you're going to make some laws about smoking, don't bother with outdoors banning, because it's not really going to do any good And what it is going to do is extend the police powers and police harassment and create more opportunities for them to...
fuck with people.
Right, yeah, exactly. Right. Very concisely put.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling in, caller, and keep those, keep your research up and, call again.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. I actually am able to go online and find the agenda for the city council, which usually isn't posted on Thursday nights. I usually wait till Friday, so I'm glad to see it's posted. City agencies have gotten pretty damn sloppy about providing information to the public, at least on occasion. I know that I tried to get the audio tape for the last downtown commission hearing. That's the commission that's supposed to be considering things like the smoking ban, since it's on Pacific Avenue. It's going to have an impact on business, have an impact on the community. They should be looking at the ordinance and talking about it. Jerry Mandel, who I don't know, but I suspect to be a big supporter of this ordinance, maybe not. I haven't actually heard her position, but it seems like a Mandelish ordinance. She's the chair of the commission, and she didn't put it on the agenda. When I asked June Hoffman, who's another member of the downtown commission, why not, June had no idea. And it's sort of like the batch of anti-homeless laws that came out in January and February out of the city council that said, three infractions make a misdemeanor, 1 hour limit on benches, expanding the forbidden zones for where you can sit, spare change, perform, or have a political table. None of these went through the downtown commission, though they all are clearly have direct impacts on Pacific Avenue and the downtown. And the reason they don't go through the downtown commission is I think the point is to put them past them as quickly and as silently as possible. Although actually, with this bit of laws, it wasn't silent. They had a whole bunch of businesses who had been previously informed about these ordinances while the rest of the community had not. They showed up en masse, whereas the rest of the community only had 3 days' warning or so about the ordinances. Now, I'm looking at the Santa Cruz City Council agenda to see when this comes up. And it looks like... Oh, they didn't even put it on the evening agenda. They're going to try to pass it on the afternoon agenda, it looks like. They're having public hearings instead on special use permits to create a duplex on a corner lot and the 86-room hotel with partially underground parking that is happening. It doesn't quite say where, but I think it's on the west side somewhere. But the actual... second reading of the smoking ordinance is on the afternoon agenda. And that means you have to show up at 3 o'clock, and then you get your 2 minutes to speak. Cynthia Two-Minute Matthews will give you, our mayor will give you 2 minutes to speak. At the same time, they're going to be increasing fines on parking meters, costs on parking meters. They are going to explore other revenue measures. They're going to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the earthquake, and they are going to establish a safety enhancement zone, budgeting the largest amount I've heard of, $50,000, I think in the past it was $30,000, to fund the local and allied law enforcement for overtime lighting, restrooms, and equipment. You may remember in past years they've come up with such brilliant plans as fencing off most of the street, although I think they didn't do that the last 2 years. And you have these sort of goon squads of cops marching around in military formation to deal with any problems that may arise, if you know what I mean. You can catch from the tone of my voice what I think of that. That's on the consent agenda next Tuesday on the 3 o'clock session. And also on the 3 o'clock session is the smoking ban. And I don't think it's been clarified exactly. I see the smoking ban. I'm looking it up to see if we can see what the deal is here. I don't think they even have the staff report. They just have the final ordinance online. It's uh, It's interesting. Here are the findings. The city council finds that numerous studies find that tobacco smoke is a major contributor to indoor air pollution, and breathing secondhand smoke is a cause of disease in non-smokers. A U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has classified secondhand smoke as a carcinogen for which there's no safe level, and so forth. Various people at risk, children, elderly people, individuals with cardiovascular disease and impaired respiratory function, including asthmatics and those with obstructive airway disease, for sure. Health hazards induced by breathing secondhand smoke include lung cancer, heart disease, and they go on and so forth. Cigarette butts are a pervasive form of litter. Careless smoking is estimated to be the number one cause of fire-related death and injury in the nation. While the majority of these cases involve indoor smoking and careless extinguishing of smoking materials, many of them are the results of littered cigarettes, whether tossed out of a car or thrown on the ground by pedestrians and bystanders. So they're trying to make the claim that there's going to be a fire on Beach Street or Pacific Avenue or, let's see, where are the other places where it's banned? They're banning it in all enclosed public spaces. Well, actually, a lot of this is already in force. The new part is on the Beach Street right-of-way between the Municipal Wharf and 3rd Street, on any portion of the Pacific Avenue right-of-way in all city buildings, in Abbott Square, and I guess Municipal Wharf, which may already be the case. So, and city parks, which currently is the case in San Lorenzo, and I think it's Grant Street Park due to the edict of Parks and Rec Czarina Danette Shoemaker, who just certainly made that edict a year or two ago. Now it's being turned into a law. Notice that there is nothing about the toxicity of outdoor secondhand smoke. They don't even use the words outdoor secondhand smoke. So it isn't really a very persuasive finding for me. I mean, if they have a real finding that shows outdoor secondhand smoke has been shown to be in some significant and verified way a health hazard, then that would be a good reason for banning it. Or you know, setting up certain zones. I mean, you have people who are asthmatic, and you have people who have health problems, but do you want to punish other people for the disabilities that still other people have? And I don't think that's the way to go. I think, as I said before, the voluntary compliance approach is better. This is going to be happening on the afternoon City Council agenda for those who are interested on Tuesday. And I'm going to leave it at that. And I'm going to turn now to a few other items. Food on trial. Food Not Bombs appeals city ordinance. This is sort of a teaser for Keith McHenry's appearance, or I should say his verbal appearance, on Sunday. He's going to be calling in. He's the co-founder of the Food Not Bombs nationally, although there is no real national Food Not Bombs. Food Not Bombs is a label and an idea that groups throughout the world have taken up, which involves essentially reusing vegetarian food. I think most Food Not Bombs are vegetarian. And doing so in a public way where poor people are feeding poor people and showing alternatives to conspicuous consumption of fancy, expensive foods, and also that the priorities of spending money, massive amounts of money on armaments and so forth, instead of on basic needs like food and shelter and medical care, are way fucked up. Anyway, here's an article. On Monday, September 21st, Abe Bobman II will appear in front of a hearing officer from the State Department of Public Health in an ongoing battle over the status of Middletown's chapter of Food Not Bombs. The group, which consists primarily of Wesleyan students, was issued a cease and desist order by the Middletown Health Department last March for dispensing food without a permit to members of the community. According to Middletown Health Department, Food Not Bombs is in violation of the municipal code. The group is now in the process of appealing the decision, and I'm told by Keith McHenry, still serving food anyway, as we did here in Santa Cruz when they tried to ban us from serving food at different times. Our argument is that the state and city health codes do not apply to Middletown Food Not Bombs, said attorney Elizabeth Conklin in an interview with the Argus. Food Not Bombs is not a restaurant, it's not a kitchen, it's simply a group of people who share food as part of a broader political message. Members of the group avoid referring to their actions as serving food, instead preferring the word sharing. The hearing was divided into two parts. The city made its case at the first session in August, and now Food Not Bombs will present its side. City officials declined to comment on the grounds that they are not permitted to discuss ongoing litigation. At the first hearing, which was originally scheduled to take place in the smallest conference room in the state health department building, and it had to be relocated due to the larger-than-expected showing, the city's two witnesses, Salvatore Neschi and Fred Rem, were questioned and cross-examined. It does seem like the hearing officer has greater sympathy with the Middletown Health Department because she herself is a member of the state health department, said Bobman, who was arrested and charged with a misdemeanor for his involvement with the group. She seems sort of skeptical about Food Not Bombs. Conklin acknowledges that succeeding at the appeal hearing will be a challenge. As a general matter, it's an uphill battle to prevail at these administrative hearings, she said. We believe Food Not Bombs should prevail, and we're doing everything we can to get things back the way they were. If the hearing officer rules in favor of Food Not Bombs, the cease and desist order will be nullified, and the group will be able to continue as it has for the past decade. If she rules in favor of the city, Food Not Bombs may pursue an injunction against the city. The best-case scenario would be that a precedent would be established in Connecticut and possibly nationwide that would give other Food Not Bombs chapters the opportunity to be immune from law enforcement, Bobman said. Despite the cease and desist order, Food Not Bombs has found a way to continue cooking and dispensing food with the help of the First Church of Christ Congregational on Court Street. We wanted to keep feeding people, but I didn't want to see the members of Food Not Bombs getting tickets, said Anne-Marie Cannata, executive director of the Buttonwood Tree Cultural Center, where Food Not Bombs dispenses food. So I came to First Church and said, why don't we help them cook and let them use the kitchen? And our community at the church said, yes, we want to help them. Because the kitchen at the church is approved by the health department and Cannata is a qualified food operator, Food Not Bombs' current operation is legal under Middletown Code. While Cannata said she sees no reason why the partnership cannot continue permanently, Food Not Bombs members would still like to be free to cook and share food on their own terms. At a recent Middletown Board of Health meeting, a potential ordinance was discussed that would exempt certain types of groups like Food Not Bombs or PTOs, not sure what those are, from permits and regulations required to serve food. Right now, I could conceivably be prosecuted for making a pot of stew at my house, carrying it down the street, and giving it to you, Bobman said. This ordinance would be an effort to clarify what the city regulates. The ordinance was postponed at the last meeting and will likely not be voted through until at least November if it gains enough support. In the meantime, Food Not Bombs members continue to meet Sundays at 11 a.m. at First Church and dispense their food at the Buttonwood Tree. The most important thing for us is to be able to continue cooking our food and sharing it with our friends, Bobman said. There are hundreds of these organizations doing these things, Conklin added. They're not able to function fully right now, and that is a violation of their First Amendment rights. Or say, rather, they function fully, but with the threat of arrest, as we have done here in Santa Cruz. They haven't actually used the arrest threat in a long time, but what they've done is instead they pressure behind the scenes. And the people who are the main food providers who are on the streets, Food Not Bombs still serves, I think it's twice a week, once at the Drum Circle Wednesday at 4 o'clock, and I think they also show up at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific on occasion. But let's say Dennis Adams, the pastor who serves a big Sunday meal, used to be downtown, kind of slightly up the street from the Cinema 9 Theater on the other side of the street. I think it's where Verizon Wireless is now. He was driven away by pressure from merchants who didn't like the homeless riffraff gathering. He moved different places. I've kind of followed his adventures from the Vets Hall. They drove him out of the Vets Hall. They drove him out of the Vets Hall parking lot. He tried to do it in a parking garage, and they tried to use the parking lot panic lock, Coonerty's law that says he can't be in a parking lot unless you're walking through or parking your vehicle. You can't even sit in your car. That's illegal. Unless you have a permit, of course. This whole idea about requiring permits for everything is a way, obviously, of cracking down on spontaneous, natural, traditional behavior without any real basis for doing so. I mean, if there was some major health hazard that was stalking the town, there was some big, you know, I don't know, a salmonella scare or sepsis was coming out of these, you know, Food Not Bombs meals. But that's never been shown to be the case. In fact, people get sick. People I heard of getting sick get sick at the homeless meals where they have a certified kitchen and where they have people who are cooking. I'm not saying a lot of people get sick. I'm not saying it happens all the time. But that's where I hear people getting sick. I haven't heard of people getting sick at Food Not Bombs feedings or at Dennis Adams feedings. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It just it hasn't reached my ears. Let's see here. You know, I'm going to be talking on Sunday about subjects I don't have time to talk about today. Tad, the Arcata activist who is fighting against the sleeping ban and the tendency of city authorities to try to run homeless people out of town or out of sight, he has recently been convicted of resisting arrest because he spoke 22 seconds overtime at a Board of Supervisors meeting, and the police arrested him and then didn't try him for speaking for 22 seconds. They tried him for, quote, resisting arrest. That was the charge that I was being charged with in 2005 when, in a very similar situation, I stood at the microphone of the city council and tried to speak at all, to say something on an item on the city council consent agenda, which a number of other people had spoken on, but I was told by then-Mayor Mike Rutkin I could not because I had spoken on other consent agenda items, and therefore I couldn't speak on this one because I had used up all the time I was allowed, even though I actually hadn't really intended to speak on the item, but I think some of the speakers had sort of inspired me to speak, and I wanted to say something. That should not be, and under the Brown Act, is not something that the mayor should be able to suppress. But in our city, that kind of suppression happens regularly, and people are afraid of it. And they essentially, like good doggies and good lemmings, and, you know, essentially people just don't want any trouble, you know. And also, they don't want to offend the powers that be if they're trying to get something from them. They shut up, sit down, they keep it quiet. And when that's going to change, I don't know. When people are going to stand up and assert their rights again, you know, I don't know. But I know that it can happen suddenly, and it can happen because one person does it and then another person does it, and people suddenly take courage from each other and they realize that their rights are being stripped away and that they are colluding in this process, and they don't want to collude anymore. They want to say no. I'm gonna speak about this issue, and the meeting may take a little longer, but that's part of the process. A couple of things on the international scene. Afghanistan, General McChrystal is seeking another 40,000 troops for Afghanistan, despite claims earlier in the day from President Barack Obama that no immediate decision was pending on Afghanistan. This is by Jason Ditz, a story yesterday. Fox News is quoting sources, and the government is saying General Stanley McChrystal has already made his long-awaited troop request, and it's a doozy. General McChrystal is now privately requesting another 40,000 troops for the 8-year-old war, which would bring the overall U.S. presence there to well over 100,000 troops and nearly triple the number in the nation with President Obama when he was elected last November. The call's private nature and President Obama's protestation that no decision is pending are likely a function of growing Democratic opposition to the escalation, rather feeble opposition, I might add, with polls showing a wide majority of Americans and a dramatically larger majority of Democrats now firmly against the war, but not voting against the military appropriations. Thank you, Representative Farr. Several top-ranking congressmen are questioning the wisdom of continued escalation, questioning but not voting against it, and are expressing concern about the lack of concrete plans for an exit strategy. And, of course, this is nicely put, but in fact, if Bush were in power, none of this would have been possible. Let's say if McCain had been in power and the Democrats in opposition, they couldn't have gotten away with this. But, of course, with Obama in power, they can. Which is why I say that in many ways, Obama is worse than Bush. We have the same policy, and no opposition to it, no organized opposition to it in the Congress. How well the military is going to be able to cope with the increased number of troops deployed in Afghanistan is unclear, particularly with 131,000 troops still in Iraq and more on the way. It had previously been reported that General McChrystal would seek 20,000 more troops for the conflict. And here's an article to escalate the escalation by Ivan Eland. That's an article, I think, again, from antiwar.org. The debate rages among experts on whether to escalate the escalation of Barack Obama's war of necessity, quote-unquote, in Afghanistan, seemingly oblivious to American public opinion at home that has turned against waging the conflict at all. During even the best of times, Washington could be isolated from the rest of the country and the world. Now the imperial city and most of the politicians, both Democrat and Republican, who run it, seem to be reenacting an episode of the incomprehensible television series Lost. In the old American Republic, politicians would have considered it suicidal to escalate a war in opposition to public desires. Even during Vietnam, when Lyndon B. Johnson conducted his massive escalation, the war was not yet unpopular. Even facing the stiff wind of popular opposition and very little chance of winning, whatever that means, the Afghan war, U.S. generals are likely to ask for and be granted more troops than the 21,000 already added. And I'm having a little trouble with my computer. Let's see here. An example of the depth of the delusion in the Obama administration is the known concern about the second escalation by Robert Gates, Obama's defense secretary and one of the most astute members of his rather poor foreign policy team. Gates is worried a bit surreally that if even more U.S. troops are added to the 68,000 that will already be there, they could be seen as an occupation force. Apparently, even Gates has not processed the loud and repeated protests of the Afghan people and government about civilians killed by U.S. airstrikes. Newsflash, the U.S. is already seen as a foreign occupier and puppeteer behind the corrupt and now fraudulent Afghan government of Hamid Karzai. Many experts say the U.S. lost the Vietnam War because the corrupt U.S.-backed South Vietnamese government lost popular legitimacy. I don't think it ever had it, but that's another matter. The U.S. may now be in a similar pickle in Afghanistan. Today, Washington's hallucinations rival those during the Bay of Pigs fiasco, when the U.S.-backed Cuban exiles were allowed to fend for themselves on the beach during their failed invasion because President John F. Kennedy denied them the use of their own and U.S. air cover in order to keep U.S. involvement a secret. No matter that everyone in the hemisphere already knew that the U.S. was training the invasion force in Central America because the New York Times had done several stories on it. Hang on here. Again, losing my a little trouble with this computer. Not only is the U.S. occupation force in Afghanistan incensing Afghans, it is fueling the resurgence of the Taliban there and aggravating the rise of Islamic militancy in nuclear-armed Pakistan. In both cases, the perceived meddling of infidels on Muslim soil is stoking resistance. With the guerrillas' knowledge of the conflict's center of gravity, popular opinion in the invading country has been likely irretrievably lost to Obama, as well as their advantages in terrain, zealotry, and an Afghan population that does regard American presence as an occupation, they will likely outlast American will to fight. One would think that Obama would have no other choice but to scale back his military efforts in Afghanistan and Pakistan to do to something more manageable, but which would also be less counterproductive in the fight against al-Qaeda. But his experts have convinced him that those nations will again become havens for al-Qaeda attacks against the United States. The problem with this flawed logic is that almost any, quote, failed state in the world, such as Somalia or Sudan, would need to be rebuilt in similar fashion, or it could become a haven for al-Qaeda. Such a policy would further outstretch an already overextended U.S. military and inflame Islamic militants everywhere. Instead, the U.S. could use law enforcement, intelligence drones, cruise missiles, and maybe an occasional special forces raid whoopie-doo, to neutralize Al-Qaeda. How about, you know, changing some of the policies of the government? I don't know. What a concept. As well as pay off local chieftains to provide intelligence on Al-Qaeda or prevent them from providing a haven for its operatives. The United States has successfully used such techniques to keep Al-Qaeda at bay since 9/11. Yeah. Osama bin Laden is likely to be in Pakistan, not Afghanistan, and the Taliban is not Al-Qaeda, the real adversary to be neutralized. I don't agree with this puffing up of Al-Qaeda as some sort of major menace worldwide. Unfortunately, the United States has gone beyond these light footprint tactics and has gotten away from this main objective and into feudal nation-building and drug interdiction eradication. The Obama administration, seemingly more analytical and pragmatic in foreign policy than the ideological Bush administration, may eventually realize that the stark realities call for a scaled-back and less counterproductive approach to fighting terror. But by then, it will be, it actually already is, Obama's war, and the Republicans will bait him into staying longer by beginning to ask who lost Afghanistan, much as they tagged Harry Truman with having lost China back in the 40s. Of course, on his first day in office, if Obama had really been astute, he would have declared that both Afghanistan and Iraq were Bush's unnecessary wars and called for rapid U.S. troop withdrawals. He didn't make that wise move, but there is still time for him to do an about-face before further escalating a lost cause, which is counterproductive to his stated goal of neutralizing Al-Qaeda. This is a kind of a, oh, please, Mr. Obama, make the right choice. And here's a story by Glenn Greenwald. In Iraq, freedom is marching backward. Muntazar al-Zadi, the Iraqi journalist who famously threw his shoes at George W. Bush last year, was released from prison after 9 months. The person who invaded and shattered al-Zadi's country and caused the death of hundreds of thousands of his fellow citizens, Bush, hasn't suffered, almost certainly won't suffer any consequences. Al-Zadi claims he was tortured in prison, just some beatings, whippings, electrical shocks, and simulated drownings, nothing a few U memos, some New York Times NPR linguistic whitewashing, and looking forward, not backward mantras can't take care of. He also plans to go into hiding out of fear that he will be hunted down and murdered by U.S. intelligence agents who are still occupying his country. He also said he feared U.S. intelligence services regarded him as an insurgent revolutionary and would spare no effort in a bid to kill him. I want to warn all my relatives and people close to me that these services will use all means to trap and try to kill and liquidate me either physically, socially, or professionally, he said. I wonder how many Americans, and specifically American journalists, regard al-Zadi's fear as irrational hysteria, of the type for which the Arab street is notorious, like those raving Arab conspiratorial paranoids who prior to the invasion actually believed that the U.S. wanted to establish permanent military bases in that country rather than attacking Iraq in order to spread love and democracy with its freedom bombs. Those Arab crazies even doubted that Saddam was in cahoots with al-Qaeda, even though our leading Middle East experts, such as Jeffrey Goldberg, proved this time and again. They just don't think rationally as we do. There's a lot of sarcasm in this particular story, in case you're not catching it from the tone of my voice. As Chris Floyd reminds us this morning, it is well established that the U.S. has indeed created death squads inside Iraq to kill anyone it perceives to be an insurgent. In 2008, Bob Woodward revealed, or rather confirmed, the existence of what he called the key element to the success of Bush's escalation of the war crime in Iraq, a secret killing program aimed at assassinating anyone arbitrarily deemed a terrorist by the leaders of the foreign forces occupying the conquered land. In a TV appearance to puff the book, Woodward celebrated the arbitrary murder by methods unknown of people designated terrorists by criteria unknown as a, quote, wonderful example of American ingenuity solving a problem in war, as we often have. And this despite the fact that, as Woodward makes clear, the targets of the American death squads are not merely terrorists, as the general public broadly understands the term, i.e. religious extremists in the Al-Qaeda mold, but anyone arbitrarily designated an insurgent or a leader in the resistance. That is, anyone who resists the invasion and occupation of his native land is deemed a legitimate target for a secret death squad, for execution without charges, without trial, without evidence. And this, to Woodward, is wonderful and amazing. It would probably be more irrational for al-Zaadi not to have the fears he has than to have them. One of the things that Washington political class now tells itself to justify its support for the invasion is that while things may not have gone as well as we would have liked for the first 5 years or so, at least we've created a better country, as well as a better country for Iraqis. Why aren't they more grateful? And left a fledgling, spunky democracy in the middle of a region that will provide an excellent example for everyone around them. Except, as The Economist details this week, that really isn't true. The Shia-led government is overseeing a ballooning of the country's security apparatus. Human rights violations are becoming more common. In private, many Iraqis, especially educated ones, are asking if their country may go back to being a police state. And I'm running out of time. I believe we're going to have some Uncle Dennis wannabes will be in the studio shortly. Uncle Dennis does a show right after mine, From the Cream to the Dregs. So I'm going to have to leave this article. If you're interested in it, you want to read the rest of it, you can catch it online. It's by Glenn Greenwald, and it's In Iraq, Freedom is Marching Backward. I want to thank everybody who's been listening, and the one guy who called in, for doing so, and I hope that I can round you up again for the show on Sunday, or you don't be rounded up. If you're interested, tune in again. More important, do something with the rest of your time. Keep your eyes open for instances of police misconduct, and essentially stand up for the rights of the people around you when they're being put down by those in uniform with badges and guns, or by those asserting laws that essentially remove basic human rights for poor people, like the sleeping ban, like the sitting ban, like the spare changing ban. And I hear the pounding at the door, so I think we're going to have the Norse ban shortly. See you again, or we'll talk again, I should say, on Sunday, 9:30 in the morning. Join me then, or give me a call at 423-HUFF, and we'll huff and puff at each other like that.
And water and blood was all you could see. 64 was the number that drowned. Brown water and blood was all you could see. The day that the George Prince went down. On a Monday morning at the end of October, Mississippi all covered with fog. George Prince was leaving to take them all over. Children to school and men to their jobs. But brown water and blood was all you could see. 64 was the number that drowned. Brown water and blood was all you could see. The day that the George Prince went down. Now up in the wheelhouse, while he'd been drinking, old Muscatel was morning routine. And out on the deck, the deckhand was thinking, not a damn thing exciting ever happens, it seems. But brown water and blood was all you could see. see. 6 to 4 was the number that drowned. Brown water and blood was all you could see. The day that the George Prince went down. Now the air it was cold, but water was colder. Children on board never grew. And husbands support their poor families. Still commuting to work from far under the sea. But brown water and blood was all you could see. 6 to 4 was the number that drowned. Brown water and blood was all you could see. The day that the George Prince went down.
Bring my friend, I said you called up a robber.
And welcome to From the Creams to the Dregs. And this is Rick with my friend Coral here. Say hi, Coral. Say hello.
Hi, Coral.
And we're sitting in for Uncle Dennis tonight, and here we go. I think.
You can't see me.
and a great Beatles cut. Oh, anyway, well, it's good to be here. This is my first time on the air, basically, so be nice to me if you're calling, all right? Anyway, Coral and I are here for Uncle Dennis, and we put together a bunch of stuff from the 60s and 70s, a lot of Beatles stuff and Cream, and or as my my mother-in-law used to say, the Creams. I love those Creams, the Creams, and you know, just a bunch of stuff, some McCartney stuff and Police and stuff that I know you'll recognize. And so let's see. Here we go with just one more little Beatle cut.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind there. Did I suddenly see you? Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life? You didn't run, you didn't lie, you knew I wanted just to hold you. And had you gone, you knew in time we'd meet again, for I had told you. You were meant to be near me, ooh, and I want you to hear me say we'll be together every day. Got to get you into my life. What can I do, what can I be when I'm with you? I wanna stay there. If I'm true, I'll never leave, and if I do, I know the way there. Ooh, and I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life? Got to get you in the mood.